How does radicalization happen? Why would a young person living in Australia adopt an extremist ideology and even pursue their beliefs through violence? With me today on Open for Discussion is Hussein Nadim, a doctoral candidate in the University of Sydney's Department of Government and International Relations. Last year, Hussein was named by Forbes as a global leader in law and policy. He's advised the military and security agencies of Pakistan on de-radicalization and counterterrorism issues, and been a special assistant to the federal minister in Pakistan's government. He's frequently invited to give briefings to the U.S. State Department, Pentagon, and the U.S. Senate, looking at issues in Afghanistan and the Pakistan region. Thank you so much for joining us, Hussein.
Pleasure to be here.
I feel like after that introduction, I need a security clearance to talk to you. This is incredibly impressive. Can I ask what brought you to this work?
Well, I think it wasn't a choice. You see, I was born and raised in Pakistan, and it was a time period when the first the Cold War was ending, the first Afghanistan war, and Pakistan was just beginning to see its problems of terrorism, militancy. And growing up in that era, I've seen how my country, Pakistan, drifted from a very stable, economically prosperous country, and a country that was very progressive in a lot of ways. And over the period of over 10 years or 15 years I was growing up, I saw that country taking a very wrong turn. The institutions collapsed, the militancy spread, people became radicalized, and there was a gun violence and a gun market that was flourishing in that country. So you see, living in that part of the world where you see terrorism and militancy firsthand, a lot of my family has been a victim of terrorism through different instances. And it's not just my family. Every Pakistani that I've met so far has some family member who has been affected by terrorism. For us in that part of the world, in South Asia, terrorism is real. It's not something that we watch on the TV. It's something that we feel. For months, the schools were closed down in Pakistan. The economy collapsed. And there was a genuine fear. When you're living in that condition, you start thinking beyond yourself. You start thinking beyond a 9-to-5 job, beyond just living on some salary. And you become a lot more radical in a way where you want to contribute towards bringing stability in that society. And I think that was one of the reasons why I chose to pursue international affairs and international security. And that was something that I worked in for 5 years in Pakistan on different aspects of security. And I'm doing the same thing for my PhD as well, because partly I think it is not a matter of choice. This is something that we need to fix back home.
Do you do the PhD and then return to Pakistan?
Yes.
Is that your goal?
That's the goal.
And then would that be working as an activist with an NGO or working with the government, with the federal ministers that you've worked with in the past?
I believe in working with the government. So I think a very small change on the government level can bring a drastic change on ground. Over millions of people that we're talking about. So very small, minor changes that you can do can have a huge impact. So for me, I think in places like Pakistan, I think the government needs major reforms. That's where the real contribution I would like to make it.
If the goal is to pursue de-radicalization, what constitutes radicalization? Like, how should we think about it, or how should we think about it differently than maybe we do?
You see, radicalization has become a very controversial subject now. The term itself has become kind of politicized in a way. I personally feel that radicalization is simply a process on how a certain individual acts in a particular way. It could possibly a good radicalization, it could be a bad radicalization. I've seen tons and tons of, after 9/11, there were tons and tons of initiatives in Pakistan and across the Middle East where young kids would come out in support of bringing reforms in religion, bringing reforms in the government. So that was also positive side of radicalization. Unfortunately, the media sees only the negative side of radicalization. So I believe that radicalization itself is not bad. The way you use that energy, specifically when we talk about the youth, is what basically distinguishes between the good side of radicalization and the bad side of radicalization.
It seems like radicalization is also brought into a specific kind of racial context, in a certain kind of religious context as well, that where they're talking about it in this negative way, and they're talking about very specific people in very specific circumstances.
I mean, of course, radicalization is not exclusive to any specific community or gender. It's basically a part of the growing up process, I think. I mean, I think it starts from the basic question of being inquisitive about how the world is working, why certain tensions are there. I mean, if there is no denial that there is a lot more radicalization, the youth is radical in the Middle East, Pakistan, Afghanistan region. It's partly because I've lived in those areas, and we see problems firsthand. We see non-responsive governments, we see failing institutions, we see failing health services and everything. So that kind of makes you wonder why we are this way and why other parts of the world are flourishing. And specifically when you have an exposure of living in the US, I did my undergrad from the US, was in UK for 3 years for the grad school, and now in Australia, you wonder at times walking in the streets that why is our countries and our regions in a total mess and how these countries have flourished. So, I mean, either you can be very disgruntled, you can become very mad, you start becoming politicized and you start hating on the West. Or the other way is you become radical enough to learn the good practices that these countries have adopted, go back to your country and start to change those countries from within. And I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to go back into the government and do my part. So I see the West and the Western countries as possibly a good case studies of how we can build nations.
So then we should differentiate between radicalization and extremism. When we talk about radicalization, we're really often talking about extremism. Is that fair?
I don't think it's fair, because I think radicalization is a sort of mindset. Extremism, on the other hand, specifically when we talk about violent extremism, that's for a specific purpose to harm or to put somebody to danger. So these two things are very separate. Unfortunately, I think the way media uses some terms in a very broad strokes, that is where a lot of people start equating radicalization with terrorism and extremism. Whereas I think if we adopt radicalization, where we accept radicalization as a positive thing, we might be able to counter the negative aspects of radicalization. Because right now, a lot of Muslim kids who are growing up, for them, being political is being considered as somehow being negative, because radicalization has become so connotated with negativity that any kid who's asking questions is almost shut down that you're becoming a radical, which automatically means you're a terrorist now. So I think that has to be distinguished.
That's an important point. Where do you see the role of economics and or with socioeconomic backgrounds toward extremism, let's say, rather than saying radicalization?
I think socioeconomic factors matter a lot, but there are competing debates on it. And I don't think any debate has any empirical evidence specifically to suggest that poverty, socioeconomic aspects are the core reasons or not. But here are certain things that I've personally noticed while working specifically in Pakistan and in Fata regions, lawless regions where, there are towns and villages in Pakistan, 2,000 people villages, 1,500 people villages, which do not have TV, which do not have schools. The only thing that they have over there is basically a radio set. And that radio is being polluted by this massive religious hate propaganda against the West. So, I mean, the kids growing up in those regions where there is no access to information, where those kids do not even know that they live in a country which is Pakistan, it's very easy for those kids to fall prey to this terrorist propaganda. My essential point is that socioeconomic factors do not essentially mean that these are the core reasons why somebody turned to terrorism just because of poverty. But they provide an ample ground for terrorist outfits to go and recruit people based on the idea of fear. I mean, I conducted interviews in 2012 in the Fata region in Pakistan, and a lot of people who turned to radicalization or eventually became suicide bombers and were able to blow themselves up, designated fear as the major reason why they turned towards radicalization. They had no idea about 9/11. They had no idea about the United States. They even didn't have any idea about the war going on in Iraq or anywhere else. So for to say that somehow these kids who are turning into militants have a very hardcore ideology or somehow they're pressed by socioeconomic conditions is wrong. Sometimes they're just there to protect their... I mean, half of the kids said that they feared that their mothers and their sisters would be raped by the American forces, which is why they're doing what they're doing. So the fear is what I think really matters more than anything else.
Wow. I was thinking the whole time when you were talking, I was like, okay, what were they afraid of? And your point is that there's sort of this myth or this story or this fable of, you know, U.S. imperialism coming in and taking over sovereignty, whatever it is, that you have these powerful narratives that come in and the socioeconomic conditions feed into it, even if they're not the single variable themselves.
I mean, the socioeconomic conditions are much dependent on the government. I mean, if you have villages where there are not any schools, there's no health services, kids are traveling almost 200 kilometers every day to go to a school. I mean, that's what the situation in some of those regions are. I don't blame the kids who are then turning to militancy, because the government essentially is absent. You're not allowing those kids any other opportunity or any other way to be exposed to the world. I would say that radicalization is less to do with what the militants and the terrorist outfits are doing. It's more to do what the governments have not been able to deliver. And this is one of the fears that I have when I talk to the Australian government about de-radicalization programs in Australia, that sometimes radicalization can be caused by having bad policies. And this is what my fear for the Australian government and Australian society in general is, that do not make the same mistakes that the European countries, especially Britain, has made through their de-radicalization programs, which have caused more radicalization and more hate for the West in the Muslim communities.
Hussein, what are some of the specifics of the programs or policies that you would say that have caused more significant problems or even increases in radicalization?
I think there are a couple of issues to that. One and foremost is the way it is talked about. When you talk about radicalization, you're specifically talking about a community. You're calling it Islamic radicalization, Islamic terrorism. I mean, there are 1 billion Muslims over there. If radicalization was part of Islam, they all would be cutting throats right now. So stop blaming a particular community. Stop attaching connotations to that, because that kind of triggers a lot of Muslim kids to feel that they're not part of the Australian society. So the entire narrative of the militant organization, specifically using social media from Iraq and Afghanistan and recruiting kids in England and in Australia, is to ensure that those kids grew up feeling that they're not part of the Western society. The us versus them divide has to be there. And that divide is being created a lot more by the conversation of, I think, the Australian government, the politicians, the media, the way it uses some terms. And then the second part is some of the programs that are being run in the schools. I've been one of the biggest critics of the Australian government spending $57 million on running de-radicalization program at the school level. One, there is absolutely no way to gauge the impact of de-radicalization programs. So essentially, the programs that you're developing, you don't know if they're going to work, because you don't have the tools to gauge whether they're working or not. I mean, you're targeting those schools which are in a mostly Muslim populated areas, which essentially means that you're going to be picking out kids in the class with Muslim sounding names, with Muslim sounding backgrounds, and you're going to be putting them in the specific corrective centers where you're going to be running de-radicalization programs on them. I want to see how those kids come out of those programs and feel that they're part of the Australian society. I think they're going to be very pissed at the Australian government, and they would feel that they don't belong over here. I personally feel that radicalization, the negative side, starts very much from the domestic household level of where Muslim kids grew up. For instance, Muslim parents fear that somehow their kids will end up going to clubs, to bars, they might start drinking, which is against Islamic ideals, and somehow they will end up getting married, their daughters or their sons will end up getting married outside the Muslim community. And these are the worst fears, because that means that the future generations are not going to be Muslims. Now, when they are in Australia or in the United States and the kids are growing up, the parents unconsciously try to feed a very wrong side of the Australian society or the American society, that somehow all these things are wrong. Now, that essentially becomes a problem, because the kids then need answers. When they ask their parents questions, why are we like this? Why can't we do the things that other Australians are doing? The parents do not have answers. And that's where the real problem is. Almost every kid that I've talked to in Australia, in England, and in the US have same things to say, that their parents have taught them that these things are wrong. And they're living in Australian society or a Western society where those things are normal. So essentially, there is a disparity on what they're being taught at the parental level and what they see out in the public. So my second suggestion, which I've given to the Australian government, is talk to the parents. Have a program with the parents, because parents can right from the very early age, develop either a very strong connection of their kids with the Western society that they're living in, or they can actually seclude them.
So is there an example of a good de-radicalization program, or are there good elements of it that could come from other bodies, whether that's the nonprofit sector, whether that's mosques, or whether that is government?
Chris, I've worked and reviewed de-radicalization programs for almost three governments now, the U.S. government, the Pakistan government, and the Australian government. Almost all of them would be unanimous in saying that we don't know whether they have been successful or not. If we look at the past 10 years, the attacks and terrorism has actually increased in the Western societies. Look at Paris, look at Britain, look at the U.S. So I personally think that the government should shelf all the de-radicalization programs. They are designed to be a disaster. They're designed to be a failure. What you need to be doing is, right from the top, your messaging and communications has to be correct. Essentially, the Prime Minister office and the government leaders, the political brass, has to reach out directly. And you know, it's very simple. Attending one event a month is not really a big deal. But the message that it sends out to the Muslim youth is very different. The message that they will receive is practically the fact that they're part of the Australian society, they're given the importance, and they can be involved in Australian policy making and the Australian society.
And so if you were going to send the Prime Minister today somewhere in Australia, where is there a group or a community center or a city or a event that you would recommend that they go to?
Sure. I mean, there are tons of Muslim societies. Start from going by the Muslim student associations at different universities. SUMSA over here at the University of Sydney has over 400, 500 membership. Why doesn't the Prime Minister or any other minister or senior political leader come and attend one of the sessions? The message that it will give out is going to be very different. It's going to be that the Australian government is actually deeply involved in listening to the problems faced by the Muslim community. And that is all what is needed. The message has to change within the Muslim community. The narrative has to be challenged. The terrorists are developing a narrative that your government, the Australian government, does not care about you. You're not part of the society. And the only way to actually counter that is by doing exactly the opposite. I mean, look at Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. We don't need any other de-radicalization innovation method. Look at the messaging that comes out of his Facebook pages, the Twitter pages. You have trucks in Pakistan who have picture of Justin Trudeau on their back. That's how popular he is in a country like Pakistan. So he's doing essentially what needs to be done, reaching out, going down to the communities, connecting with them, and showing them that they're part of the Canadian society as anybody else.
Can I ask about the role of the media? Because it seems like the discourse that we're using here, whether it's the way that we talk about radicalization, the way we talk about extremism, that the media is playing a role in educating us predominantly, and they're not necessarily getting it right.
The problem with the media is not specifically exclusive to Australia. When you have media houses which are more interested in the ratings and they have become commercial organizations, then really what we're selling is a sensational news. And it's kind of like a cyclical process where the media is reinforcing certain images about Muslims, certain biases about Muslims. That is where the real problem is. One of the things that I've noticed is this idea that somehow when a white man goes and shoots some people in a club or at a church, that's called homicide. That's called a mentally unstable white man doing an attack. But if a similar thing is done by a brown man or a Muslim, that's considered terrorism, Islamic terrorism. And I think that narrative is kind of playing into the hands of the terrorist propaganda, because the media houses want to frame Muslims in a particular way, and that Muslims can never be part of the West. The terrorists are basically sitting back and saying that, look, we told you this is the way it is. And a lot more people are now buying their argument unconsciously that West is a problem. Second, I think it's important to find different news sources as well, because that can give you a very different perspective. We've kind of become very comfortable in reading the news that actually we like. So we're following the people that support our ideas, reinforces your belief system.
Well, I do. I follow Tony Abbott, and he goes completely the opposite of my belief system. In terms of, you know, the digital revolution and social media revolution, what role do you think Twitter has in a policy sense, as a policy instrument, to affect change?
So I started using Twitter when I was in the government of Pakistan, and it was out of a necessity, I thought. Pakistan has 200 million people living there, and Twitter users are around about over 75 million Twitter users in that country alone. Twitter was one of probably the best ways, and along with Facebook, to reach out to that public and kind of feel the perception. Back in the days, we would have to go down to the constituencies, go to the town hall meetings, talk to a lot of people. It has become a lot more easy to have more inclusive policies, to get a policy feedback, to reach out and tell the communities, to tell the public that this is what we're doing. It has brought transparency. It has brought accountability. It has brought us feedback methodology where we directly know in real time whether our policies are working or not. And I think essentially it has changed the way the government works. The other side is the side that I use Twitter as a PhD student and as a policy activist. I think from this side, Twitter is even better. Twitter now allows me to bridge that divide between the policy and the student. You're able to reach out to any sitting prime minister, to any sitting politician, and ask some real questions and expect an answer as well. And I think this is one of the best parts about Twitter, that people do actually respond. I've had conversations with senior political party leaders from around the world, to State Department, to etc. And I mean, and the way they can provide answers in real time kind of makes you feel that the public sector has evolved in a lot of ways, and it has become accessible. I mean, a lot of people feel very comfortable just by using Twitter as a source of information and source of even answering their basic questions about the government. So it's kind of way, in a way, strengthening the government, strengthening democracy, if I look at Pakistan. And it's healthy for the civil society, I think.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Open for Discussion, Hussein Nadeem.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us on Open for Discussion. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud, and you can find me on Twitter at Christopher Neff. If you'd like to know more about our research, be sure to visit our website, sydney.edu.au/news.